from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the Trump transition, President Obama's final trip abroad, a leadership challenge for Nancy Pelosi, fake news, the alt-right. It started bumpy for the Trump team, ousted transition team member and former Michigan Rep. Mike Rogers on Tuesday.
I think there is some confusion going on about a chain of command coming out of New York. Hopefully they'll get that settled pretty soon.
Now, names are coming. In Europe, President Obama worked to reassure nervous allies.
The next American president and I could not be more different. We have very different points of view, but American democracy is bigger than any one person.
And concerns over Trump's choice for chief strategist, alt-right champion Steve Bannon. Here's Anti-Defamation League CEO Jonathan Greenblatt on the president-elect's pick.
We believe that he's a president for all the people. So it's troubling to see him appoint as one of his senior advisors someone who doesn't support all the people.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Robert Costa of The Washington Post, Kathy Gilsonan of The Atlantic, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see shaping up on the Trump team? What are you thinking as President Obama talks one last time to Europe? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post. He's got his eye on the Trump transition. Robert Costa, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Great to be with you.
And with us from Washington is Kathy Gilsonan, senior editor at The Atlantic. She oversees international news coverage there. Kathy Gilsonan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Robert, and Kathy.
Robert, first to you. Lots of talk or turmoil earlier in the week. In the last few hours, plenty of names coming. Let's look at these. Jeff Sessions, retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, Mike Pompeo of Kansas. First, if you characterize these overall, Robert, what do we see if you put this together with Reince Priebus as chief of staff, Steve Bannon as chief strategist, what is shaping up in the flavor of the Trump the Trump cabinet?
The loyalists are certainly having a seat at the table with Senator Sessions, Lieutenant General Flynn, now retired, with Steve Bannon. These are the more hard-edged conservative types who have been around Trump throughout the campaign, and now that they've been guiding the president-elect during the transition. Trump, who's more of a pragmatist on some issues than most people realize, recognizes he is a total outsider in Washington. So he has been turning to Priebus to be a liaison to the establishment, to the party leadership in Congress. But Trump is someone who puts loyalty and trust at the top of his list when it comes to personnel, and that's being reflected in the kind of people we see as appointees.
Robert, take these one at a time if you'd be good enough. Jeff Sessions first. We talked to them last week. Just before the election, he was with us here at On Point and said, look, immigration's always been a big issue of his. Here was Jeff Sessions last week.
Donald Trump is talking about one America, treating people as Americans first, whereas you've got this constant problem of Secretary Clinton and Barack Obama appealing to one group against another one. I was shocked at Obama's conversation with a Hispanic reporter when he didn't condemn her argument that people illegally here were citizens and ought to be able to vote.
Okay, I don't know about the president and that argument, but take current policy in the Justice Department. Imagine Jeff Sessions, and of course this is subject to review by the Senate, but if he's AG, what does the change look like, Robert?
In Sessions, you have someone who throughout his career has been deeply conservative, ideological, and also anti-establishment. Immigration is at the fore of his agenda. As Attorney General, you could expect Senator Sessions to be someone central in thinking through border policy enforcement. Sessions has also, throughout his career, advocated for limiting legal immigration, not just cracking down on illegal immigration. So he would be not just a populist within the Trump administration, but somewhat of the conservative soul of an administration that's in part run by a former Democrat in Trump.
In 1986, he was nominated. This is way back now, but this story sticks with him. nominated by Ronald Reagan for a federal judgeship, rejected by the Republican then-controlled Senate Judiciary Committee because of racially charged comments and actions. At that time, he was one of only two judicial nominees whose selections were halted by the panel in about half a century. He had called the NAACP and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and other civil rights groups un-American, communist-inspired. An African-American federal prosecutor then had said Mr. Sessions had referred to him as boy. Is that behind him? Is it still, is the sting of that rejection still in him, Robert?
That sting of the rejection has been with him. I've covered him closely in the Senate, and he's somewhat of a loner, an outsider inside of the upper chamber. He has risen to some stature, especially on the American right. But you can expect these charges and that whole confirmation fight from the 80s about racially charged comments. People have called him racist, his critics, to come back. And this is going to be part of the discussions. At the same time, Leader McConnell, the majority leader, and other senators have grown to know him. So he's a known quantity. Mm-hmm. And you can expect that to help grease the skids.
Retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, what's his reputation if he's the National Security Advisor? You already spoke to some of his views on Islam and the threats there that he describes quite broadly. What would the change be in the tenor of advice coming to the next president?
Flynn is someone who has a combative personality. He's also grown close to Donald Trump, participating in intelligence briefings. He had somewhat of a falling out in the Obama administration. He is someone who is now
wasn't
seen
he fired?
By, he was let go. The Flynn people say he was not fired. He kind of left. Obama people say he was certainly fired from being the director of the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. He has his ties to Russia television and its American incarnation here, RT. His relationship with members of the Russian government has come under intense scrutiny in recent months, and that's also going to be part of the discussion. But Flynn benefits, unlike Sessions, he benefits from not having to have Senate confirmation.
Ties to Russian television, also ties to Turkey. What was that?
Flynn, ever since he has left government, has been participating in a lot of foreign entanglements, consulting. It's something that we saw with his group called Flynn Intel Group. He has, in a sense, worked with Erdogan's government in Turkey through companies tied to the Erdogan government in his consulting business. And that's something we've seen in his winter ever since he left government.
Erdogan now in the process of kind of a big national purge in Turkey and finding Mike Pompeo, congressman out of Kansas, to head the CIA director. He's close to Mike Pence, we understand, a Harvard Law School grad. What's his background? What qualifies him for this position, Robert?
I've known Pompeo for some time as a reporter. He comes from Kansas. He's close to the Koch brothers in Kansas, the Koch brothers based there in that state. He's seen as an ally of that wing of the party.
The very conservative.
Mm-hmm. Very conservative, business friendly. He is also one of the sharper members of Congress, according to his friends and associates in the House. They say he went to the U.S. Military Academy, graduated at the top of his class, Harvard Law School. Mm-hmm. He's also a hawk, which makes him different than Trump. He's friends with Bill Kristol at the Weekly Standard and other top hawks in Washington.
In the interventionist vein, potentially.
Exactly. Much more of the interventionist vein, not so much of the Donald Trump hands-off view of the world.
Kathy Gilsonen, look at this from a global perspective, particularly Michael Flynn and Mike Pompeo. If these are representing American national security and intelligence, how does that change the American view of the world?
I think one of the big issues, particularly with the Flynn appointment, although Pompeo has also voiced some pretty harsh criticism of of Islam, is the reorientation, the possible reorientation of the government toward this sort of clash of civilizations worldview of sort of the West versus Islam. I think Michael Flynn in particular, part of the reason, one of his major frustrations with the Obama administration, which contributed to his departure and which he voiced on the campaign trail alongside Donald Trump, was Obama's studiously moderate tone in terms of not condemning Muslims, not condemning Islam as a religion. Flynn has more taken the position that the violence arising from certain societies in the Middle East is intimately tied to Islam, and he famously tweeted a video recently that's along with the tweet that said, you know, fear of Muslims is rational. So I think one can expect a shift in tone, at least relative to sort of the conciliatory approach that Obama and the Bush administration before him has taken vis-a-vis Muslims, and saying, you know, being careful to insist that extremists are such a small portion of the community that we really need to work together in order to defeat extremism among us, that Muslims are our best allies, etc.
Jack, that would be a big change from the Bush administration and 9/11 forward. So much effort not to get into a clash of civilizations. George W. Bush, very keen on always making the distinction between Islam generally and terrorism.
Yes, and General Flynn, I just saw the clip earlier this year, he said, Islam is a political ideology that hides behind a religion. He said, fear of Muslims is rational. There are 15,000 Muslims serving in the U.S. armed forces. There are nearly 1,000 New York policemen who are Muslim, who are protecting Trump Tower right now. In Iraq and in Syria, U.S. advisors are working with Muslim soldiers. And now President-elect Trump has put a man with these views closest to his ear on national security.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, Trump in transition, Obama's farewell tour, a challenge to Nancy Pelosi, Steve Bannon, Michael Flynn, Jeff Sessions, Mike Pompeo, names now coming out of the Trump transition team. Robert Costa is with us, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Kathy Gilsonen is with us. She's senior editor at The Atlantic, looking at international news. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What do you see shaping up on the Trump team as the names begin to come out? What's going through your mind as you watch President Obama make his last turn on the world stage? And what do you think of the Trump family role in the news this week? The son-in-law may be lined up for a top job, Ivanka hawking her bracelet, the kids running the Trump empire while dad runs the country. Is that all right? Here's Michael Flynn. This was at the Republican National Convention. He's now Donald Trump's choice for national security advisor.
There is no substitute for American leadership and exceptionalism. America should not fear our enemies. In fact, we should clearly define our enemies, face them head on, and then defeat those that seek to threaten our country and our way of life.
Retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, let go by the Obama administration or out anyway. Callers, Gary in Hickson, Texas. Gary, thank you for calling. You're on the air, sir.
Yes, sir. I was kind of miffed by the people that he's picking myself. I did vote for him, and I'm not in any way a racist like the mainstream media has claimed that we are. However, I do have a mistrust of Islam, the radicalism of it, and obviously a fear and safety factor for my family and my friends. Now, that doesn't mean that Islam is not to blame for such activity. I personally believe that if Christianity was acting in the same manner, that I would expect those people that say that they're good Christians to step up and help, you know, eradicate such activity. Now, these people that he's picked, they are obviously very opinionated about Islam themselves. But as long as they're trying to make America first, I kind of tend to want to trust in them before I judge them, I guess.
Gary, what do you think about the former presidents here, President George W. Bush and Barack Obama, have warned against getting into a clash of civilizations, making it all out kind of, here we go, back to the Crusades, you know. There are 1 billion-plus Muslims in the world. If we go broad brush,
and we don't single out those, and many Muslims say they want nothing to do with the terrorism. If we go broad brush, do you make it into all against all here?
Yeah, and that is a good point. You do have a good point there. Obviously, our societies are way different. Our values are, you know, they touch a lot in the same, but then there's a lot of differences in our values. I don't think that you're going to be able to change anyone's opinion, any religious beliefs or views, through trying to push your views on them. But you're right, we do have to kind of get along. It is a small world, after all. These are things that, you know, all of us face. Is this country's next to this country, and, you know, they might be friends, they might be enemies, but we still have to kind of be a mediator when it comes to that.
Gary, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Kathy, in terms of policy, can you picture how policy in the Middle East or in terms of international relations may change if you've got a national security advisor who has a broad and deeply disparaging view of Islam, if you have a CIA director who comes out of a, you know, much more hawkish school?
I think it's worth noting also that the terrorism threat, how you define it is different depending on who is doing the defining of it. I think that there are many who would argue that the problem, you know, that terrorism is being generated in the Middle East not because of Islam as such, given all the Muslims that are not participating in terrorism, which is most of them, but because of the political conditions of civil war happening in the Middle East right now. I think as far as policy is concerned, you know, many of the United States' most important allies in the fight against ISIS, for example, are in fact Muslim countries. So it's hard to see how countries like, and they're still waiting to see what's going to happen, obviously, but how countries like the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and so forth are gonna participate and assist U.S. campaigns in the region when there is this vocal sort of skepticism of their faith coming from the U.S. side.
You've got David Duke, former Grand Wizard of the KKK, tweeting today about Michael Flynn. Great pick. General Flynn's retweet shows he knows that Saudi's ISIS and the Jewish neocons are the real enemies, not Assad and not Russia. I mean, Robert Costa, okay, there's word that maybe Mitt Romney and Donald Trump talking today in some consideration, or at least the ideas out there, I don't know who floated it, of Mitt Romney potentially as Secretary of State. Does that sound for real to you, Robert? Are we going to have a solid wall of Mitt Romney seems very moderate now compared to a lot of people Donald Trump is bringing in. Could you see him in that role?
I could, actually. Romney has spent much of his time in retirement ever since the 2012 election thinking through foreign policy. I was with Romney a few years ago in Park City, Utah, when he gave a presentation to donors and reporters about his view of the world and how he'd reorganize Foggy Bottom. So Secretary of State, his allies tell me, something that would actually be on his list is something he would be willing to do. Of course, he and Trump have contrarian views, different kinds of perspectives on Russia and other fronts, things that would really maybe make it difficult for Romney to be Secretary of State. But Romney always thinks about service to the country. Look at his father, George, joined the Nixon administration as housing secretary, even though he had been kind of a critic of Nixon. And so it's something that's in the air today at Trump Tower. Not likely, but it's certainly a possibility.
I mean, there have been other names floated on that front this week, Kathy. Take us through the Secretary of State top options.
Well, Rudy Giuliani was floated, but it seems as if he would run into congressional opposition. We were also talking about it seems as if a lot of names have been floated for just various different jobs. So, for example, Jeff Sessions' name was floated for Secretary of Defense, but he's ended up as Attorney General. We were talking about Newt Gingrich for a little while, but then he told McClatchy that he's not considering taking the job.
Nikki Haley out of South Carolina this week. Her name out
Nikki
front.
Haley out of South Carolina.
Is that for real?
So, sorry?
Was that for real? Is she a serious contender for that role?
I think I think we have to treat every name floated with about equal seriousness at this point. And I think Nikki Haley in particular, you know, to be cynical about it, Donald Trump has gotten some criticism for the gender composition of his picks so far. So I think potentially if he's interested in displaying an interest in diversity, then Nikki Haley could very well be a serious pick.
Anthony in Detroit, Michigan. Anthony, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm okay. What do you see?
Well, I see, honestly, it's kind of weird. I'm glad your guest just mentioned the gender issue of his appointments. I'm noticing a racial issue. They're all white. There's no diversity. It's glaringly obvious. It's like an elephant in the room. And then the biggest elephant is that, dude, this guy is appointing people with white supremacist views. How come we're not, like, shouting this from the rooftops? I'm sorry, but the only person who I see trying to threaten our way of life is Trump and all these people he's bringing in that are trying to, like, hurt a peaceful, diverse society that we have.
Anthony, I appreciate your call. Let us pick it up right there. Jack Beatty, you can follow a thread there. David Duke speaking up this morning, formerly of KKK, but what about Steve Bannon? He's drawn the most attention on this front, Jack. Steve Bannon, who, of course, was at the top of Breitbart News, where there was a lot of alt-right, which often means white nationalist commentary under his leadership. Now he's at the elbow of the president. And you hear Anthony in Detroit looking at this, feels white supremacism in the White House.
It's shocking. And it's, you know, it's as if with this appointment, Mr. Trump is institutionalizing the darkness and divisiveness of his campaign in his administration. Mr. Bannon is the William Randolph Hearst of the alt-right. The more one reads about him, the more it seems he flourishes on hatred. I have a quote here from 2014. Let the grassroots turn on the hate, because that's the only thing that will make them do their duty. Who are them? The Republican establishment. Paul Ryan. He said vicious things about Ryan. And that's, again, of course, when we get into minorities, when we talk about Muslims, whatever it is, this man is the sort of cynosure of it. And to have him there, it is a disgrace, I think. And I just think Stephen Greenblatt rightly said from
top of the show here from the
Anti-Defamation ADL, that this is a sad day when such a person can serve at the, you know, right next to the president in the White House.
Robert Costa, does the Trump transition team make any apologies for Steve Bannon's background there with the alt-right at Breitbart, or they say that's just not what this is about? How do they respond to the pretty heavy criticism this week?
Well, Bannon has his past writings and his past statements, which will always be part of the Steve Bannon story. But inside of Trump Tower, he's not seen as someone who's an agitator for white nationalism, but it's more of a nuanced view. Some may not agree with this, but mm-hmm. they see him as someone who's a kind of a populist in the Brexit mold, who sees Trump as a global populist figure. At Breitbart, they see him as a media provocateur who clashed with the party leadership and came up with the big ideas that Trump likes, the political theater, things like going to Mexico to meet with the president there. That had Bannon's fingerprints all over it. That's the kind of thing you can expect from him in the White House.
I mean, Jack, you know, Mao said revolution is not a dinner party. If Donald Trump wants to turn over the tables, and if that's what voters sent him to Washington to do, then it's not going to be all patty cake people in there.
Yes, absolutely. And President Obama was, one could say, generous to a fault when he said that a president-elect has to have people around him who have his confidence, and that this is part of what a president needs to do. But you just can't overlook how outside what used to be thought of as the mainstream of even conservatism Mr. Bannon is, and what he's associated with is. And, you know, after the 1988 campaign, the Willie Horton campaign, President Bush the First, the people who ran those ads weren't institutionalized in the White House. The president accepted that was what you did in campaigning, and they, you know, Lee Atwater et al. Were kept out, not with Mr. Trump.
Let's go to Cheryl in Metairie, Louisiana. Cheryl, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I have 2 points I want to make. Hold on. Sorry about that. One is that I want to say that I don't think that all of Trump supporters, or I like to call them Trumpians, are racist and bigots, but I do think that the vast majority of them are. I mean, to say that what you like about Trump is that he speaks our language while he's speaking things like, you know, racist language, bigoted language, misogynistic language. I'm sorry. I mean, excuse me. You know, it doesn't make any sense. And so that's one point I want to make. And the other point is that this whole thing about the Democrats being in disarray and then they have to have a, you know, autopsy, I don't buy that. Because, first of all, Hillary not only won the popular vote, she won it by over a million, and she won more votes than any other candidate in history.
Cheryl, is your perspective dominant in Metairie, Louisiana, or are you in the minority there?
No. No, I'm a complete... And yes, I do know some people who voted for Trump, okay, because they voted Republican down the down ballot.
Yep.
And I don't consider them racist, but I'm perplexed by it. But I knew that was going to happen. I mean, I'm in a deep red state, you know, ruby red state.
Yep.
And so I'm not surprised, but I am very, very disillusioned and saddened, and in some ways very much ashamed to be called an American right now.
Cheryl, we've got more to look at. It comes to that in a way. Thanks for calling. We've got President Obama in Europe this week looking to explain what's going on or trying to reassure allies there. Here he was at a press conference in Berlin with German Chancellor Angela Merkel talking about American and European values.
The commitment of the United States to Europe is enduring, and it's rooted in the values we share. Values that Angela just mentioned. Our commitment to democracy, our commitment to rule of law, our commitment to the dignity of all people in our own countries and around the world.
Kathy, what about it? Angela Merkel sort of laid down almost a minimum hurdle for Donald Trump on values when she put out her first statement of support saying she'd support him if he followed X, Y, and Z values. What's President Obama's challenge in Europe this week? Is it doable?
Good question. That was such an interesting statement from Merkel, too, because I read through it and you couldn't actually find a note of congratulation. It was sort of this shot across the bow saying, we offer you our partnership, mm-hmm. but it is essentially conditional on these values.
But the values she laid out have always been seen as American values, American ideals.
Which is what's been so interesting watching Obama's trip to Europe, where he's in Greece, he had to make sort of a vocal defense of democracy, which is incredible when you consider it in the context of his first big Europe speech when he was still a candidate in Germany, where he was talking about walls going down all over the world and people becoming increasingly interconnected and the march of freedom around the world. How things have changed in the interim. I think part of his job, of course, is to reassure NATO allies that that the Trump administration is not going to be a disaster for them. And to some extent, at least rhetorically, he's succeeded. Jens Stoltenberg, NATO Secretary General, mm-hmm. today said he has confidence that Trump will live up to U.S. commitments to NATO. So who knows?
Jack, there's the president with a swan song tour of Europe and defending... It's all the way back to fundamental American values that he's in the position of saying, "Don't worry, they'll stick around."
Yes, and it's a tough sell there. I saw one poll over 80% of Germans are worried, either extremely worried or just worried about what Trump will mean. And you know what's striking in Angela Merkel's conditional congratulations to Mr. Trump is the stress she does lay on values, because of course that's the language that Mr. Trump has all but dropped in talking about American foreign policy. With him, it's all the deal. It's all, you know, how much are you paying for NATO? How much are you paying for your defense? And Germany isn't paying enough. But the language of values, no, that's not his language.
Germany fell far short of its commitment on defense spending last year. We'll see what comes now. America First, the message of the Trump team. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Blue Apron. providing pre-portioned, fresh ingredients with easy recipes delivered to your door. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/onpoint. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, pioneering PBS anchor Gwen Ifill died from cancer at 61. She remembered her own childhood in a 2009 conversation with civil rights leader Julian Bond.
We grew up with the understanding that you had to fight for almost everything you got, that people were going to deny you if they could, and that you shouldn't carry it as a chip on your shoulder, but as a way of setting up what your standards ought to be to overcome.
Pioneer Gwen Ifill. Wildfires blazed across the drought-stricken southeast this week, scorching more than 100,000 acres. Southern Region Commander Kevin Harville.
Even though you may see any given fire reach 100% containment, that doesn't mean we're going to leave. It's really going to take about an inch and a half of rain.
And Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Leon Russell died this week at 74. Unforgettable. Here is his A Song for You.
I've acted out my love and stayed in love with 10,000 people watching. But we're alone now and I'm singing this song to you.
Leon Russell, gone. We're looking at a week in the news. Trump in transition, Obama's farewell tour, a challenge to Nancy Pelosi. We'll look at that and more. Robert Costa is with us, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Kathy Gilsonen is here, senior editor at The Atlantic. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. Are you surprised, satisfied with the manslaughter charges against the policeman in Minnesota in Philando Castile's death there? Are you following the fake news mess on Facebook and Google? The Oxford Dictionary picking post-truth as word of the year? The bombing of that children's hospital in Aleppo? The surge in hate crimes? The death of Gwen Ifill? Donald Trump talking about closer relations with Russia in Syria, in Aleppo. A particular hospital became a target on Tuesday in the ongoing conflict there. This report's from NBC News' Richard Engel.
The only children's hospital in eastern Aleppo was bombed, witnesses say, by Syrian helicopters. It served 4,000 patients a month. No more.
No more. A children's hospital gone. Tannen in Bloomington, Illinois. My hometown. Tannen, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Okay, what do you see, Tannen?
Well, I had a question. As a person of mixed race, I'm black and white, and I've personally experienced racism myself, but also the white half of my family is from rural Illinois, from very small towns. Mm-hmm. So I kind of get a perspective from both sides here. I want to know if Trump and the people that he's bringing in, and also with the Republicans being able to, rule all parts of government right now, is there any sign that, you know, what they have posturized, what they've done, and what they've said during campaign, if they're actually going to be able to help rural class white voters like they have said? Because I know that there are a lot of problems that they face with joblessness and stuff like that. And if any of the things that he's proposing will actually help them.
Tannen, you're a good and generous man. Robert Costa, we've talked a lot this week about working folks on this show and working white voters who played such a big role in key upper Midwest states in particular. What do you see shaping up in the Trump program, if we can see anything yet, about how that may actually bring a better economic circumstance into that particular community?
Those states, those voters, remain important to the president-elect because you can see it reflected in how he's thinking through his upcoming schedule. A victory tour is being planned through the upper Midwest, the Rust Belt, to try to keep those voters with Trump. And on the policy front, you have congressional Republicans like Speaker Ryan. They're pining to do corporate tax reform and sweeping changes to entitlements if possible. While Trump is trying to keep that populist flame alive, you see it in his tweets last night, earlier this week. He talked about keeping 4 jobs in Kentucky. Those tweets have been scrutinized for being somewhat inaccurate, that Ford was always going to stay in Kentucky. But the point, the takeaway, is that Trump is trying to think about jobs, white working class voters in particular, and how he can keep them on his side.
Todd in Waupun, Wisconsin. Todd, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you so much, Tom, for having me on. Mm-hmm. My main concern this past week and during this transition is there has not been a press corps to follow the president-elect. And I think that is sort of a, something that goes against tradition. And it also, in some ways, speaks of a man who maybe doesn't want to be scrutinized. And as comfort to myself, too, I would say this. The Republicans own this. And what they have is what they're going to get. So I'll let you go with that.
Yeah, Todd, thanks for your call. I mean, Robert, I'm going to bring that one to you again. There are reporters in the lobby at Trump Tower in New York watching people come in and out. But this pool that traditionally follows the president, of a few reporters who follow the president everywhere, that is not consistently happening. Is it happening at all, Robert? What's the importance of that, and what's going on?
What we're seeing is the shattering of norms when it comes to the press. Usually a president-elect, and of course presidents of the United States, have a traveling press pool, and this is what enables the public in times like the Kennedy assassination in 1963 or when Ronald Reagan is shot outside of the Hilton in Washington, to always have a reporter or a couple of them at the president's side to track his movements, to keep the public informed, not always reporting everything they see, but being there. With Trump, he is reluctant to have the press around or too close every day, 24/7. And so when he went to a steak dinner the other night, the press wasn't there, was told he was going to be in Trump Tower, but he slipped out. And so this is causing some real tension between the transition team and the press corps. It's something that has not really been resolved. Trump remains a tight-knit inner circle, wary of the press, confrontational with the press. And it's going to be, I think, an ongoing drama with this administration.
That is something to behold. I mean, Kathy, if we don't have that kind of coverage, a shattering of norms is absolutely the right phrase for this. I mean, Americans expect to kind of know, really know what's going on with the president. That will not necessarily be the case here, Kathy.
No, and I think Trump has, in various ways, especially via Twitter, expressed sort of hostility to traditional ways of distributing information. You know, he's shattered norms in the ways that he's trying to speak directly to voters without, and criticize sort of the media filter, and talked about the failing New York Times and so forth. So my read on this is that it's consistent with his general approach to his campaign, that he feels hard done by the media and doesn't trust them to deliver his message, and would probably much prefer to just be tweeting directly at the American people.
What happens when we put the press on the outside like that? Apparently, we're seeing already, and we'll see more, I guess. Peter in Boston.
Indeed.
Peter, thank you for calling. You're on.
Yeah, hey, Tom. Just some background. I've been a practicing attorney about 42 years in Boston, BU undergrad, BU law school, so I'm well aware of what happened.
Take us to the news, Peter. What do you got?
Here's a perspective. I didn't like Hillary. I reluctantly voted for Trump. But I want to give a perspective of combat veterans. I just came back from a Marine reunion down in Texas. And I tell you, almost the consensus, some of the guys voted for Hillary, some for, but the consensus of the combat veterans, absolutely, we needed a change. Ashton Carter was the worst Secretary of Defense we've ever had.
Why?
And as was Ray Mabus. And here's the reason. What the Trump administration has to do is stop the neutering of American military. And by that I mean, is they're more concerned with PC, of how to integrate gays and transgender. And again, not as if they're civilians. The war fighting is not at all concentrated on. The veterans I've talked to, Black, Hispanics, they're afraid to say anything because they keep dumbing down. Women in combat, and for example, in the Marine Corps, all the physical tests, they're dumbing it down because the women can't do it. And it's just something, for example, the ships getting captured. Not one word about, hey, maybe these Navy men should not surrender. And, like, let's emphasize war fighting.
By Iran and the Persian Gulf there, I mean, I can see Donald Trump is probably going to retweet you right away, Peter. I can see that he might. But, Jack, this is a familiar lament from a certain time. Mm-hmm. I think not long ago we thought maybe we were in a different time where, of course, the country wants a strong military, but that it would be aligned with a broader understanding of the American public and its welcome, its engagement, regardless of gender and sexuality and all the rest. There's the pushback, and it sounds like pushback that a Trump administration might well embrace.
Yes, and one would hope, for the sake of variety and representing what America is, that the changes set in train by the Obama administration will continue. The Army, the armed forces have in a way led America, not lagged, but led on integration and on putting and on integrating the changes in the society first. And I think we're seeing that in the armed forces now, and obviously it leads to tension. But has it interfered with the war fighting? CNN looked into this, and over the last year and a half, our forces, and I think this means strictly American forces, but coalition forces broadly, air forces, have killed about 27,000 members of ISIS. That's a lot of killing. I think five Americans or something like that have died. We don't want any to die.
It's an amazing number, actually.
But it's an amazing number, and it doesn't suggest to me, at least, any timidity about going after the enemy.
Melinda in Boston, you're on the air. Thank you for calling, Melinda.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a 26-year-old white female of middle class. I was born and raised middle class.
Yep.
This was my third election voting. The first two elections I voted Republican, and this election I did not. And the reason for that is because I'm scared. I'm scared for my reproductive rights. I'm scared for my Muslim friends' rights. I'm scared for my gay friends' rights. We're all scared here. So what about us? What about us Americans who are scared for us, scared for our future children? What about us? You know, this is, at first it was, yikes, there's Trump and Pence in the White, they're going to be in the White House. And now we see the people he's appointing to his staff. And it's to the point where I'm actually scared. It's not like, oh, we have some people who can sway and help him out. He's hiring people who have said awful things about women, awful things about Muslims, awful things about blacks, Mexicans, gays, anything. It's like, what about us who are actually scared here?
Melinda, we've got it. And that is a note that we have heard throughout the week. Of course, not from everyone, but certainly from many. You might take some comfort in. Here was Hillary Clinton. She talked to the Children's Defense Fund on Wednesday. This was her first public appearance since her concession, Melinda. I don't know if you've heard it. There, she was encouraging her supporters to keep fighting.
I know this isn't easy. I know that over the past week, a lot of people have asked themselves whether America is the country we thought it was. The divisions laid bare by this election run deep. But please listen to me when I say this. America is worth it. Our children are worth it. Believe in our country, fight for our values, and never, ever give up.
Robert Costa, now the Republicans have the White House, they have Congress. They've got their sights on the Supreme Court, of course, and the changing lineup there. What about an American like our caller Melinda? Half the country, maybe more, voted for Hillary Clinton. Can they, in this administration, look forward to some kind of bipartisanship, or is that, sharing of values, or not?
There will be some issues in which there could be consensus. Democrats will be under intense pressure to not work at times with the president elect because he is seen as such an incendiary and controversial figure by many on the left. But when you look closely at the dynamics on Capitol Hill, you see Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, a brash New Yorker. Well, who else is a brash New Yorker? And there's talk when I was at the Capitol this week about maybe Trump and Schumer could work together on infrastructure, something Democrats and many moderate Republicans have wanted to do for a long time. And as a longtime builder, maybe Trump would be willing to cut a deal. And that's going to be the test here for Trump. He's not driven so much by ideology. He didn't come in with an agenda like if a Ted Cruz or a Paul Ryan had been elected president. So it's more of a blank canvas. And how does he fill in that canvas?
We had House Minority Leader Democrat Nancy Pelosi calling the FBI Director Comey's letter about Clinton emails late in the campaign a foul deed yesterday. She went on to say that outside issues were to blame for the Democrats' poorer than many expected showing in the election.
We cannot be taking the full responsibility for what happened in the election. We have to do our after-action review thoroughly and see what we could have done differently. But a lot of it was beyond our control.
But you've got Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan saying he will challenge Pelosi for her position in Congress. Here he was with CNN yesterday saying it's time to move on.
We have the lowest number in our caucus since 1929, and we've lost over 60 seats since 2010. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, and you keep, you know, keep getting the same results. So time to move on, I think.
Jack Beatty, what do you see in the Democrats' quadrant?
Well, partly it's a generational issue. Tim Ryan is 43 and Nancy Pelosi, 76. She's emblematic of the gerontocracy of the Democratic Party. Unlike the Republicans in the House, everything is by seniority. There's no term limits. Thus, you've got Sandy Levin, ranking member on one committee, 85. John Conyers, ranking member on Judiciary, 88. But aside from that, there's something else. Tim Ryan represents Youngstown, the Mahoning County in Northeast Ohio.
Manufacturing country, or what?
Manufacturing country. Clinton carried it by 3 points, which was a loss of 35,000 from Obama just a few years ago. And the average price of a home there is $57,000. In San Francisco, which is represented by Pelosi, the average price of a home is $1,149,000. San Francisco went for Hillary 84-9. Ms. Pelosi is her net worth is over $100 million. Tim Ryan, $200,000. So there's a class character to it too. But above all, there's this sense of, look, what do we need? We're not going to get any more votes out of San Francisco, but maybe with new leadership, we could get more votes out of the heartland. That's the Ryan case.
Robert Costa, do you see at this point a Trump transition in turmoil, or do you see it getting its legs here?
I see it reflective of Donald Trump, partly chaotic, infused with some aspects of pragmatism, still finding its way.
Robert Costa with The Washington Post, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Kathy Gilsonen, President Obama reassuring European allies, or are they still agog?
If I were a European ally, I would be agog. But publicly, at least, they're trying to cope with the reality that is upon us.
Kathy Gilson at The Atlantic. Thank you very much, Kathy. And Jack Beatty, thanks as always. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.